Good morning. So I'm delighted to welcome all of you, including the Newcomb family who are sitting in the front row, to the annual Newcomb Lecture in the Neurosciences. This lecture is part of the series of activities at NIH that are being supported by the Robert Whitney Newcomb Memorial Fund. This fund was established through the Foundation for NIH by Dr. Newcomb's family to honor his memory, and we are really grateful for the opportunities that it provides to NINDS and neurosciences on the NIH campus. Dr. Newcomb began his scientific career here at the NIH as a high school student, working during the summer in a laboratory in NCI. And as for many other young people, this early exposure to science had a lasting effect. I don't know about how many of you here, but I started not in high school, but in college with a summer experience, and it was very heady to be able to actually do things in the laboratory. After completing his undergraduate work at the University of Colorado, Robert undertook graduate studies at the University of Hawaii. His work there focused on characterizing the structure and function of several invertebrate neuropeptides. He followed this interest during his postdoctoral work with Richard Scheller at Stanford, where he examined processing of several aplasia peptides. He spent most of his career at Nurix Pharmaceuticals, and while at Nurix, he discovered several neurotoxins that influence ion channel function, and he made important discoveries on the role of glutamate and glutaminase in causing damage after ischemic stroke. The calcium channel projects that Robert was involved in culminated in the marketing of Prialt, a calcium channel toxin for use in the treatment of severe chronic pain. During his research career, Dr. Newcomb had three major research interests: neuropeptides and toxins, neuroprotection during stroke, and ion channels. And recognizing these interests and his contributions to these areas, and each year the Robert Whitney Newcomb Fund supports a lecture by a recognized expert in one of these three areas. And I have to say, it's pretty consistently been ion channels and toxins. Many friends and family members have contributed to establish the fund, and they've done so because to them, NIH is the most appropriate place to further Dr. Newcomb's work on brain research and the chemical basis of stroke and aging and just how the brain works. So we're pleased to have here with us today members of the Newcomb family, Dr. Robert Newcomb, his wife Sarah Newcomb, his daughter Gail Newcomb, and her husband Ted Manley, and a very close family friend, Deborah Stevens. We thank the Newcombs who are present today, as well as all those friends and colleagues of the Newcombs who have contributed to the fund. So today's speaker is a special treat. Dr. Rod MacKinnon, who is currently the John D. Rockefeller Jr. Professor at Rockefeller University in New York City and an investigator in the HHMI. He is a particularly appropriate choice for today's Newcomb Lecture, given the impact of his work on our understanding of ion channels and toxins that interact with them. Rod did his undergraduate studies at Brandeis, where he first worked on potassium channels in Chris Miller's lab. He then went on to medical school at Tufts University and to clinical training in cardiology at the Beth Israel Hospital. He then assessed his interests and opportunities and made, at the time and even now, what some of us think of as a remarkable decision to leave behind medicine and return to Chris Miller's lab at Brandeis to study toxins that interact with the pore region of potassium channels. Soon thereafter, Rod started his own lab at Harvard Medical School, and I remember very clearly having the opportunity to speak to him for about 45 minutes and learning about the ball and chain model of inactivation. I don't know if Rod remembers it, but made something which is very complicated, quite intelligible, even to me as an anatomist. It wasn't very long before Rod realized that to understand potassium channels, he'd actually have to begin solving their structures. And he set about learning X-ray crystallography in a very systematic and ambitious way. He decided to move to Rockefeller University in New York, where he is today. What Rod has accomplished is truly amazing. He solved the first structure of the potassium channel, KCSA channel, from Streptomyces, worked out the mechanism by which these channels select for potassium ions. He solved the structure of a calcium-activated potassium channel in the open state, which revealed the mechanism of calcium ion activation of potassium channels and provides a general framework for thinking about opening and closing of ion channel pores. Most recently, he's been interested in understanding voltage sensing, and he has made many fundamental contributions. He's received many high honors throughout his career, the Albert Lasker Award in 1999, election to the National Academy of Sciences in 2000, and the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 2003. So today, Rod is going to tell us about some of his most recent efforts to understand the role of lipid membranes in the function of ion channels. Thank you very much for coming, Rod.
Thank you very much for the nice introduction. It's wonderful to be here on this occasion. I'm going to talk about, the title of the talk is Ion Channels and Cell Membranes, but what I want to talk about is the most recent work that my lab has been concentrating on, and it's really not, it's work that's gone over a long time, and it's focusing on the voltage-dependent potassium channel. What I'll do for the first few minutes of the talk is I just want to introduce methods and just some simple ideas in X-ray crystallography and the way we represent proteins. Probably everybody in the audience already knows this, but it's a nice reminder. And then a brief introduction to potassium channels, in ion channels and potassium channels in general. And then I want to focus then on the voltage-dependent potassium channel. And look at that as a little machine and give you my ideas on what we, or at least I, so far understand about this little machine. But first, the introduction. In X-ray crystallography, you crystallize your protein and you put it in an X-ray beam, and the X-ray beam gives you a diffraction pattern, which is has information about the atomic structure. And the little spots here you see are X-ray intensities that you collect by holding the crystal in many different angles in the X-ray beam. This information alone is insufficient to determine the X-ray structure, but with additional information called the phase information, which you get from a similar kind of experiment, but by modifying the protein in some way, you can calculate what's called the electron density of the protein. In a good case, it looks like this. This happens to be the selectivity filter region of a potassium channel. But for purposes here, I just want to show you this blue mesh is electron density. And you can see it takes particular shapes. And in fact, what you do then is build a model into this electron density by recognizing the shapes of amino acids and the backbone of the protein, and even the shapes of ions, and then you refine that structure against the data. Now, the one thing I want to point out here is that this is titled KCSA. It's a kind of potassium channel, and it says at 2 angstroms resolution, and of course, we always refer to a structure in terms of its resolution, which refers to essentially the frequency, the highest frequency of the Fourier components that go into making the electron density map. What 2 angstrom means is that the highest frequencies of those components are 2 angstroms in spacing. But that's different than saying there's an error in the structure of 2 angstroms. So it turns out to be able to tell the position of an atom in a crystal structure of a protein, really, you know the centroid or position of an atom in a 2 angstrom structure within an error between 0.1 to 0.2 angstroms. So about 10 to 20 divider of the resolution. So when you hear somebody say a 2 angstrom structure, that doesn't mean there's sort of a 2 angstrom uncertainty on where the atoms are. You actually know where the atoms are too, by a factor of 1 over 10 or 1 over 20 of that. So it very precisely defines within a good limit the position of atoms in a structure. Now, ways you'll see during my talk proteins represented, here are 4 different representations of what happens to be 2 subunits of the 4 subunits of a potassium channel. In represented, it's the same structure represented in 4 different ways. This is called a wire. This is called a helical or ribbon diagram. This is called an all-atom stick diagram. And this is called a CPK model. They all look different. They're all representations of the same thing. And I'm sure you all know this, but the reason we represent these in different ways is if you're looking at something very, very big, and you show all the atoms with this kind of representation or this kind of representation, it looks very complicated. So what structural biologists do if they're looking at something very big, they want to simplify the thing. So you show a structure like this or like this, and you can get a sense of where the polypeptide backbone of the protein is running. So for example, here we can say, well, it begins here and it runs up here and it does a little loop here and then a helix runs down here and then there's a strand here that runs into another helix and comes back down again. So you can get an overall picture of the thing, kind of like a subway map of a city. You don't need to know, where every little kiosk is, and you don't. So these are different representations to emphasize different aspects of a protein structure. If you're looking at something in very, very deep, great detail, so you want to get the idea of bond lengths, or really the idea of a more physical, what's something like what something is really like, it's better to look, for example, at a detailed model. So a stick atom model emphasizes the distance between the oxygens, the carbonyl oxygen shown in red here of the protein, and the potassium ion, whereas a CPK model gives us really more of a feel of what a protein would really look like. Not with these colors, of course, but you can see that, in fact, atoms are large. Almost all the space is filled inside of a protein. In fact, a protein is a very solid material, very incompressible, less compressible than water, in fact. So really, a protein is a very solid, solid structure. And sometimes it's easy to forget that if you look at a representation like this that might give you the impression that a protein is called what once a physics student at Caltech at the end of a talk asked me, it's very interesting what you're telling me, but I don't see how telephone cords could do all the things you're saying. And I thought about it for a minute and realized that, he had a point there. And I hadn't explained to him, for somebody without the background about protein structures, that in fact this is a subterfuge for something that is very different than a pile of telephone cords. Okay. So during this talk, you'll see all different representations, but the point I'm making here is realize that proteins, they're a very interesting material. There's still very much we don't know about this material. 20 amino acids make up the proteins in our body and all life forms like us. And it goes together to make the enzymes and the structural proteins and all the components that allow me to stand here, move, and talk, and you to sit here and look at me and look up there and think about it. So it's pretty amazing, this material. There's a lot we don't know about it. But for now, I'll say it's a fascinating material. Proteins are very solid in their insides, a potassium channel is a protein. Now, a little introduction to ion channels. So they're a kind of membrane protein, and as their name implies, they're important for ions crossing a cell membrane. Cell membranes by themselves, without proteins in them, are quite impermeable to charged atoms, ions. So nature has come up with special proteins to get ions across the membrane. And there are two, there are many kinds, and if I make an oversimplification, I'd say there are two general classes of ion transport proteins, ones that are pumps and ones that are channels. And the difference between a pump and a channel is a pump is a protein that can actually move ions against their concentration gradient or against their electrochemical gradient. So, of course, they have to use energy from another source. For example, maybe it will use the bond energy in ATP hydrolysis to drive an ion against its concentration gradient. So pumps build up ion gradients across membranes. Then the other general category of ion transport protein are the channels. Channels are simpler, at least thermodynamically, in that when a channel opens up, the ion simply runs down its electrochemical gradient. So here I say ion channels are passive, and that's what I mean. They don't pump ions against their gradient. When the channel opens, the ions run down the electrochemical gradient. I say they're high conductance here, and by that I mean many ion channels work near the diffusion limit, so they have very high conduction rates. So an ion, for example, crosses a potassium channel almost as fast as an ion can diffuse from solution up to the pore of a potassium channel. So what that means is the pore somehow is evolved to have very low energy barriers, so ions, once they enter the pore, can diffuse through very quickly. That is, without barriers that are not much higher than an ion normally encounters when it's diffusing through water. And selective, many channels are highly selective. So the trick with a potassium channel is that although it conducts at very high rates, it can tell the difference between potassium in the smaller sodium ion by a factor of something like 1,000 or 10,000 are the best estimates on that. And so it only lets the potassium through to a first approximation. That's called selectivity. And they're gated. And of course, that's going to be the subject of the focus of this talk, a certain kind of gating. And what that refers to is the fact that channels are not always open. They open and they close, and that's called gating, and they do that in response to specific stimuli. So it only makes sense that it's important that an ion channel in a cell membrane be open at a certain time and not open at another time, depending on what that ion channel is doing. So if it's ion channels involved in nervous impulse propagation, for example, you don't want all your ion channels open in all your neurons all the time. Okay, or life would be a brief seizure, and then it would be over. So for potassium channels, we know quite a few structures now. And potassium channels are really, among all the ion channels, potassium channels form one branch of the family of ion channels. And you can see, so here are four different kinds of potassium channels, a very little one from bacteria called KCSA. Here's a more complicated one, a calcium-activated potassium channel from another prokaryote. That is a calcium-activated potassium channel. Here is a potassium channel called an inward rectifier potassium channel. I won't talk about it in any detail. And here is a voltage-dependent potassium channel that will be the subject of this talk. You can see they're very different looking. They're all different shapes. But what makes them all potassium channels is the pore that goes through the membrane it's in the middle in this one, is very similar in all of these. And so the typical pore of a potassium channel looks like this. It actually has four subunits arranged like the staves of a barrel with a single hole, a pore down the middle, where the potassium ions flow from outside to inside or inside to outside, depending on the direction of the electrochemical gradient. Here I show two of the four subunits. The front and back subunit are removed. And you can see that there's an ion conduction pathway. And in this picture, I show electron density for ions in some selected water molecules along the pore. And so this unit is what all potassium channels have in common and what defines them as potassium channels. And in fact, a little more information, I describe potassium channels as one member of the ion channel family. But if we looked at a dendrogram or sort of a tree of relatedness for all the ion channels, you'd see that the kinds of ion channels, the branch that potassium channels exist on, is actually a very big branch that forks many times. And in fact, sodium channels and calcium channels and many non-selective cation channels all belong to the same branch. They all have four subunits, and they all have a similarity. And, you know, I call them tetrameric cation channels. Tetrameric because they have four subunits, and cation because they all have in common the fact that cations go through them. And it's something about this structure that sort of likes cations. One of the things is these helices shown in red are pointing the C-terminus, the helix is polar and is a partial negative charge on the end of this helix pointed at the center of the membrane in all these kinds of channels. And I think that's one of the big reasons why they all let cations through. But of course, they're not all the same because some of them let sodium, some let potassium, some let calcium. This kind lets potassium. And what determines who goes through is the region of the protein right here where you see ions lined up in a dehydrated state. And if we look more closely at that region, it's called the selectivity filter. And all four, the strand from all four subunits is shown. And you can see there's a queue of potassium ion binding sites where potassiums sit in cages surrounded by oxygen atoms from the protein. And so what happens is when a potassium ion is crossing the membrane, it comes out of its hydration shell in water and comes into these binding sites and can hop from one to the next on its trip across the membrane. And these sites are sized for potassium and not for sodium. That's not a subject I'm going to go into because it's not the main focus of this talk. But you get an impression looking at this structure that, in fact, this selectivity filter in each of its binding sites for a potassium selectivity filter is mimicking the waters of hydration around a potassium ion that is not held by the protein, but is in a part of the protein where there's water surrounding it. So in a sense, the potassium channel protein has sort of made an effective hydration shell, but specific for potassium ions. There's something interesting that we wondered about. The selectivity filter that I showed you, we determined the first structure in 1998 and then a higher resolution structure in the end of 2001, kept trying to get a better definition of this. But in a sense, so this was from the little KCSA potassium channel. And that was, really the sort of prototype for thinking about potassium conduction. But we wondered, gee, if we could ever see another potassium channel that is quite unrelated to KCSA, what would its selectivity filter look like? We know its amino acid sequence was in the selectivity filter region is very much the same, but amino acids surrounding the selectivity filter are quite different. We wondered what kind of structural variation would you see? And so here is the KCSA pore, and this is called an inward rectifier. And if you take all the potassium channels known and look at how the different potassium channels come out on smaller twigs of the tree of relatedness, these two are among the most separated. And so this structure is at 2.2 angstroms. This is at 2. So it allows us to make quite a good comparison of the structures of their selectivity filter. And I just want to show you that it's quite remarkable that what nature does when it has to accomplish a task, and in this case, select potassium over sodium, it conserves the three-dimensional structure of the protein. So here I'm showing superimposed the selectivity filter from these two potassium channels that are separated by a great time in evolution, actually. They're quite different in a sense in terms of evolutionary time, but in fact, they're very much the same. And in fact, the average deviation of the atomic positions here, it turns out, are within the error of our ability to determine the atomic positions at this resolution. And the way you know that is, in fact, you take a structure and you solve it many times independently with independent data sets. How do you get somebody to do that? Well, actually, it comes out naturally out of things you're studying, like different ions and maybe mutations. And what you discover just by performing the experiment over and over on independent data sets, you can find out what your real error in the atomic position is, and you can, you know, state it, you know, 0.23 angstroms, for example. And you find out that the deviations here are small, are within that error. So what it says is the three-dimensional structure of the selectivity filter of these two potassium channels are identical within our ability to distinguish. So now, the main topic that I want to talk about, the introduction is over. The main time, yeah, long introduction, but I understand I have 2 hours, right? Just kidding. So back to these different shaped potassium channels. The reason they're different shapes is because these different potassium channels respond to different stimuli. So they gate open in response to different stimuli. So this one responds to intracellular calcium. This kind of potassium channel, some versions of it respond to the lipid component of the membrane. Other versions respond to the binding of a protein called a G protein. And this kind responds to voltage. This kind we don't actually know. We can study its function, but we don't know what its physiological stimulus is. We know that changes in pH affect its gating. We also know that the lipid composition of the membrane has a very big effect on its gating. But we don't understand the role of this first potassium channel structure in its biological context of the bacterium Streptomyces levidans. This is the subject that I'm going to go into now. This is called a voltage-dependent channel. And in a way, you could say that all the work that at least I personally carried out on potassium channels ends up ultimately focusing on this kind of potassium channel, because that's the first kind, first general kind that I studied when I came into this field of ion channels. And in fact, it's the kind that sort of is most, I guess, famous or well-known in the ion channel field. And that's because of the history of this field. This field had its origins in trying to understand how the electrical system of life works. And in little more than 50 years ago now, two British scientists, Alan Hodgkin and Andrew Huxley, did some very beautiful experiments and published a series of papers on the theory of the action potential, that is, the theory of the nervous impulse. And their theory was actually, in addition to a lot of data to support their conclusions, it was a set of phenomenological equations that would describe the propagation of an impulse down an axon, which is a tubular extension of cell membrane. And the essence of their theory was that the membrane contains ion gradients across it, presumably we now know set up by ion pumps, and that these ion gradients allow the action potential because the membrane can change its permeability, first to sodium and then to potassium. And I depict this idea in a more modern way, because when Hodgkin and Huxley developed their theory, they didn't know about any of the molecular components involved. But in a sort of more modern description, but of what they really was is the basis of their theory, is this, that the picture here, these two lines are membranes, represented as membranes, and this would be a cylinder. So there's a little circle on this end and this end, and it's running from left to right. So this is inside this cylindrical shaped cell. This is outside, and this is outside. And this is, let's say, a nerve cell. And you notice that this nerve cell can have an action potential, which means a change in voltage, a fluctuation in the voltage across its membrane that can come from left to right at some characteristic velocity, depending on some properties of this system. And it carries information, course, because it's an impulse. And if you looked in detail right at the position of this axon where there's an impulse traveling, what you would discover, and if you had a great microscope and could look at things in great detail, what you would discover that where the membrane voltage, where the action potential is occurring, and what it looks like is if you put an electrode in this thing when it's at rest, your electrode on the inside relative to the outside would read some negative voltage. Then as the action potential came down, it would swing positive transiently and then back negative. And so you're looking right when it's swinging positive. What you would discover is you would see sodium channels open. And because there's a high concentration of sodium on the outside and a low concentration inside, sodium would be rushing in, making the inside positive right here, relative to the outside. And then a little bit later, what you would discover is that this sodium channel over here, that is closed at first suddenly opens. Sodium rushes in here, makes this part positive. And in fact, this one spontaneously closes. So this positive part shifted from here to here. With a little delay, the potassium channel opens. So it's the same thing as the sodium channel, but it's with a built-in delay for some reason. Properties of the protein, differences in the protein. The potassium channel opens, and if we shift over here, we can see an open potassium channel that has followed the event moving from left to right. Because potassium is at a higher concentration on the inside relative to out, it rushes out, rendering the inside negative again. Okay? Now, so the essence of it, there are two things about this theory that made it work. The first is that there were sodium channels and potassium channels, although they didn't put it that way. They said that the membrane could be permeable to sodium and then permeable to potassium with a delay. So that's the first thing, selectivity. The second property is the fact that these channels over here that are first quiescent pop open because of the activity beside them. Why does that happen? Now, the significance of that is the following. Suppose there were no channels here, and this were just a cylindrical membrane, a cell membrane, an axon, but devoid of any channel proteins. And I used an electronic device to pump in some current here and make it positive inside. What would happen is this would travel down, but it would decay away. And by the time you get over here, the signal would be gone. But because you have the channels popping open and using the energy of the sodium gradient and the potassium gradient, it sustains this impulse and it continues to propagate. Okay? So the first property, I said, is this selectivity. The second is, how do these guys know to open? What is it that told these guys that this was open and now it's their turn? So it turns out what it is the fact that this one is opening, letting sodium in, rendering the membrane positive inside, it is felt by this one. The change in the membrane voltage is felt here. And then it opens this one. So you could imagine maybe it's chemically mediated. Maybe sodium rises on the inside and binds here and opens this one. That's one way this whole thing in principle could work, but it doesn't work that way. The way it works is because this is open, makes the inside positive, this feels the inside positive, opens, more sodium rushes in. This one feels the inside positive, opens but with a delay, potassium rushes out, renders it negative inside. So this feeling of the electric potential difference by the neighbors is called voltage dependence. And that's the second essence of their theory that could allow a complete description of how an action potential propagates. Now today we can set up an experiment that makes this all easier to think about. And the experiment is a very simple one. Here you have a chamber with salt solutions on both sides. You put a membrane on a partition in between those chambers. You put a voltage-dependent potassium channel in that membrane. You hook it up to an amplifier that can control the voltage and measure the current at the same time. And now you do an experiment where you step the membrane voltage and look what happens to the current. And with a voltage-dependent potassium channel, you see the following. You hold the membrane negative on the inside of the channel relative to the out. Negative 100, step to positive 100. What you see is that these channels open at the plus 100 voltage, but they don't, 100 millivolts, but they don't open at the minus. And if you take the same kind of membrane and put many channels in it and do the same experiment, you see the following. Step the membrane voltage. This spike is a capacitive transient charging the membrane. And following that spike, when the membrane is charged, the channels open up with some characteristic kinetics. You step back and the channels close. Actually, the channels take a little while to close. In this experiment, there's potassium on both sides. So when you step back, you've captured the channels open at the negative voltage, and it takes a little while for them to reclose. But the picture here is that this protein in the membrane feels the voltage difference across the membrane. And so the voltage difference controls the gait of this kind of protein. So this is called voltage dependence. And on the last slide, I explained sort of the significance of this property to making nervous impulses, that you need this kind of property to get the propagation of an action potential. So many people in the field, ever since the time of Hodgkin and Huxley, have wanted to know what's going on here. What does this? What does the ion channel look like? And how does it work? How does it, we have, as I've shown you, we have a good sense of when a potassium channel opens. Now, let me back up for 1 minute. On that, I introduced voltage-dependent sodium and potassium channels, and earlier I mentioned that sodium channels are actually related to potassium channels because they're out on the same big branch of the tree of ion channels. So it turns out voltage-dependent sodium channels and voltage-dependent potassium channels are really quite similar. From far away, they probably look the same. It's only when you get close up, the selectivity filter will have to be different. And we now know atomic structures for the potassium channels, but not for the sodium channels. But what we know is the voltage sensing principle will be the same because on the amino acid sequence level, we can see that they're very related. As I'll show you, there's a part of this protein called a voltage sensor that allows the protein to read the membrane voltage and know whether to open in response to it. So the simple picture behind voltage-dependent channel gating is this. You could have a protein, a channel with a pore that, for example, would let potassium through, and then you could have parts of that protein called sensors attached to it that have charged amino acids. And in this depiction, it has positive charges so that when the membrane is negative inside, these are drawn inward and the pore is forced closed. Then you make the membrane positive inside. These positive charges are forced out and the pore is opened. So you get a little electromechanical coupling device. That's the basic principle that people thought of a long time ago. And what you see, if you look at something proportioned to the open probability as a function of membrane voltage, in a voltage-dependent potassium channel is a very sharp turn-on. So for this channel at minus 90 millivolts, the open probability is close to zero. And by the time you're to minus 50 millivolts, the open probability is very close to one. So it's a sharp turn-on. And it's a sharp turn-on because one thing that would give a sharp turn-on is this positive charge responsible for sensing the membrane voltage is large in quantity. And in fact, you can measure the gating, what's called gating charge, first measured by Armstrong and Bezania in the 70s. And you can measure this and, for example, ask how much gating charge does a voltage-dependent potassium channel have? And these are experiments carried out some time ago in my lab by Sanjay Agarwal using a channel called the shaker potassium channel, much like the one I'm talking about today, its structure. And here, I'm just going to draw your attention to this graph. This graph shows the amount of charge that moves, and it's not ions traveling, it's not potassium ions traveling across the membrane, but a transient current corresponding to the movement of charges in the voltage sensor, plotted against the number of channels in that oocyte membrane. So these experiments done in frog oocytes. And this graph shows that there's close to 14 elementary charge units per channel, or about 3.5 charges per subunit. There are 4 subunits, equivalent crossing the voltage membrane voltage difference. So that's a big charge, and we'll keep that in mind and come back to it in just a few minutes. Now, if you look in the amino acid sequence of voltage-dependent channels, what you discover is there's a segment called the S4 segment. So this S5 and S6 form the pore, like the pore we've looked at. And this S1 to S4 forms the voltage sensor. And in the fourth transmembrane helix, in every third position, there's an arginine or lysine, usually arginine. And we know if you mutate those one at a time, you reduce the gating charge. So these are the charges that would correspond to the little positive charges in the voltage sensor in the cartoon. And one other thing about this I want to point out to you is that these are in every third position. And so I'll come back to that in a few minutes. So the protein that we'll talk about is called the paddle chimera voltage-dependent potassium channel. It's a pretty big protein. This is the part in the membrane. This is in the cytoplasm, and I won't talk about it. You can actually cut it off, and the channel will work. It has a purpose, but it's not the subject, a regulatory purpose. The subject, it's the part in the membrane that makes the that really makes the potassium channel voltage-dependent. And a couple of technical points about this channel called the paddle chimera. It's a eukaryotic voltage-dependent channel that is mostly something called Kv1.2. It's from rat brain. I think this detail is probably not important. Steve Long and Ernest Campbell in my labs determined a structure in 2005 of Kv1.2, but it was modest resolution, and it was difficult for many technical reasons. Now, Kenton Schwartz here at the NIH did very interesting experiments looking at a part of the voltage sensor that we referred to as the voltage sensor paddle, and did very careful experiments defining, actually first showing you could transfer the voltage sensor paddle among different voltage-dependent ion channels. And he did a very careful, systematic look at what actually defines where are the limits of transferability. And he provided us with this recipe. And this channel is, in fact, a Kv1.2 with a Kv2.1 paddle. Works just fine, and it sounds like sort of arcane detail, and it is. But it has to do with the kind of, we were trying to modify crystal contacts to get a better definition of this protein structure. And the paddle corresponds to this part in red, as defined by Kenton, called S3B and S4. And so this channel is mostly this one kind, Kv1.2, but it has a Kv2.1 paddle. And here is a picture of the red part is what corresponds to the transferred voltage sensor paddle. The potassium channel pore is in the center, and there are four voltage sensors surrounding this pore. The one closest to you is removed. Another technical detail, it turns out, you know, we spend a lot of our time, you know, probably 90% of our time struggling with, as all scientists do, struggling with technical details. And technical details of crystallization of membrane proteins, you know, is sort of a consuming aspect of everybody's lab who does this. And one of the tricks that was required for crystallization of this channel was not to use just detergents to take this protein out of the membrane, but to use detergent lipid mixtures. And really, you couldn't take this protein out of the membrane with detergent alone. You had to always maintain in its purification some amount of lipid. And in the crystal structure, you see lots of lipids surrounding the protein, almost actually forming like a somewhat like a bilayer surrounding the membrane protein. Now, what is the state of this channel? So I want to show you now that the pore is open. And the way I know this is we've determined five different kinds of potassium channel structures. And two of them are closed. And by that, I say they look like this. And those look like big openings. We're looking into the pore if you were as if you were a little diver inside the cell looking out. And you'd say, well, this is pretty open. It doesn't look closed. But remember, these helical representations are a subterfuge for something more complicated. And if you look at a surface representation of these, this one's barely open, and this one has no visible opening. So they're closed, whereas three different kinds of potassium channels fall into what we'd call an open category. And the voltage-dependent channel falls clearly into this open category. So if we look at a closed type of potassium channel and an open one, you can see that these helices expand like the aperture of a camera. And so the voltage-dependent potassium channel we're looking at falls into this open state with a wide open pore on the inside. It also has this interesting feature of helices that are shown here in red wrapped around that open pore near the inside of the cell, and here's a view from the side. And so these are like little levers suspended, forming a cuff around the opening, the open opening of the pore on the inside of the cell membrane. And in fact, so we think that what happens, so this is extracted from the crystal structure, and now this is a hypothesis for how the closed conformation would look like. So this is from the crystal structure. This is actually taking the pore from a non-voltage dependent channel that we recognized as closed and just putting it there and then letting the red helices follow. So it's a hypothesis about how this pore would look like if it were closed. Now, those red helices shown in red that form a cuff, those are attached to the voltage sensors. So here's another view. Here the pore is in blue, and here are the voltage sensors. And you can see that these helices form a cuff. So somehow, motions of the voltage sensor that would move these charges relative to the membrane voltage difference have to do work on the pore. Now, when you look at this structure, this is looking down the pore, and this is looking from the side with the voltage sensor closest to you, the viewer, removed, you get the notion that, well, this is a pore of a potassium channel surrounded by regulatory voltage sensors, and the idea is that conformational changes here bring about a conformational change to close the pore. And this is very consistent with notions that electrophysiologists derived from electrophysiological data on voltage-dependent potassium channels. And that is the basic conclusion, that it looks as though the voltage sensors undergo conformational changes and that they seem to undergo conformational changes mostly independently. And then subsequent to those conformational changes, the pore can change its conformation. And this is sort of captured in the idea that the voltage sensors, there are four of them, and they can undergo many voltage-dependent transitions, and it's only after they've all undergone a voltage-dependent transition can the pore open. It's very compatible with looking at that structure. Now, how is the voltage sensor changing its conformation? So here I'll break one of them off, this one here, and turn it 90 degrees, so you'll be now looking into it as if you were standing in the pore, looking out at one of your voltage sensors. So here it is, just to orient you. It has four transmembrane helices, 1, 2, 3, in three there's the first half, we call 3A, and then it's bent, 3B, and then the fourth one comes down, and it has this helix running sideways. That's the red helix that wraps around the pore, okay? Couple of things I want to show you about this. I've shown side chains of some important amino acids, the positively charged amino acids. So remember those amino acids in the S4. Here they are. Here's one. Here is one that in this particular channel is an asparagine, instead of an arginine, but in most voltage-dependent channels, you find an arginine here and not an arginine here. It seems to be swapped in this channel. But we call this, for consistency, we call this the first position, second, third, and fourth position. These are the positions that carry most of the gating charge. Now, when we look at this, you can see that they're closer to the outside than the inside. So this would be outside the cell membrane, and this would be inside. So when I showed you that the pore is open, when we look at this, it looks like the voltage sensor is also at least more open than it is closed. And I'll show you a little bit more information on that in a minute. In fact, now, what can we say about how the motion, what kind of movements can take place? And for purposes of time, I just want to show you a summary slide, but we'll just briefly explain the following experiment. This is an experiment where you take a tethered biotin, attach it to a particular place on the voltage-dependent channel, and actually see if you can inhibit the channel with avidin, which grabs the biotin. So if the avidin can grab the biotin, it has an effect on the channel. If it can't, it doesn't have an effect. And there are many controls you can do to make sure what I just said is true. And so the idea here is an experiment where you take the voltage-dependent channel, you attach a biotin, and a biotin so is attached at a position shown with the red arrow. And now in the planar, in the lipid bilayer, you can add avidin to the inside or the outside, and you ask, can you inhibit the channel? And in this particular position, you depolarize the membrane and the currents turn on in the black trace. Then you add avidin to the outside and depolarize it, and it's like the control. So you say, avidin is not getting that from the outside. But now you add avidin to the inside and you depolarize, and the channels are inhibited. So you say this position is accessible from the inside. And you might say, well, whether it's open or closed, don't worry about it. We'll come back to that in a minute. Okay? By the way, these experiments are done on a prokaryotic voltage-dependent potassium channel called KVAP, and they're mapped onto the structure of paddle chimera because it's the best structure we have, and we think that these voltage-dependent channels essentially look the same. We have pretty good evidence for it. And what this summary plot shows now is a single subunit, and in red are sites. So you can use biotin tethers of different lengths, and I'm going to show you just for the case of the shortest tether length, which means if you put a cysteine on the protein and attach the tether to this position, the tether length is so short that the cysteine has to essentially be on the surface in order for avidin to get it. And you can test control, you know, can see if assumptions about that are true by looking at tether lengths of different sizes. You find a remarkably consistent data set if you do that. So what this shows is for the shortest tether length, accessibility from the outside at positions shown in red, from the inside at positions shown in blue, and black show positions where you can't access it. So if you tether at that position and prove that you've tethered there, you don't affect channel function. So what if you just look at this, you say, well, stuff out here is accessible from the outside, stuff in here is accessible from the inside, and positions in the middle are inaccessible. Makes sense. And in fact, of course, everybody's looking at this saying, what are you talking about? They're on the inside. I'll come to that in a minute. If we ignore this part right here, you can draw sort of a plane that would separate accessible outside from inaccessible, and you'd put the plane right here. So between these two, and between these, and between these. And similarly, on the inside, you'd place a plane between these two, in between these two, in between these two. And in fact, that plane is 29 angstroms apart, which corresponds nicely to the hydrophobic core of a membrane, although there's no assumption in that placing that plane about the thickness of a hydrophobic core. So what it tells you is, oh yeah, okay, so things on the outside are accessible from the outside, things on the inside are accessible from the inside, things in the middle are not, except in this region. There are outliers here. This is too low. It's about 5 angstroms deeper than its red neighbors. So it would imply that in the membrane, at least in some conformation, these red ones can make it all the way out here. And it would also imply that these blue ones, in some conformation, come all the way down near its neighbors, about 15 angstroms from here down to this plane level. And so how do you explain that? Well, you explain that by saying, well, this part of the protein must move. It must be able to move. Remember, I've said nothing, made no assumptions about whether it's open or closed. When I add the avidin to either side, you open and close the channel and see if you can capture in one or other conformation. And so the idea is this must be accessible from the outside when it's fully open. It must come all the way to the outside. It's already very closely there. So it would tell us this crystal structure is something very close to an open conformation. And in fact, you can make the voltage negative to hold it closed, and you can't get these from the outside, as you'd expect. Okay, I didn't have to tell you that, but it's a fact. This is apparently accessible from the inside when you hold the membrane negative. So what this tells us is that this part of the protein, this is the S4, must move at least 15 angstroms across the membrane. And in fact, that's where these charges are that make the gating charge. And so we don't know what the closed conformation looks like, but we have a sense of a very large movement in this region of the protein. This is showing a picture of the voltage sensor paddle from the KVAP channel and from the paddle chimera channel, and they have somewhat of a different shape. And they have a different shape in an interesting way. This superposition was made based on alignment of the S3A component, and you can see that the rest of it doesn't align very well. And in fact, in the KVAP, there's a break in the helix between S3A and S3B. So it makes us wonder if the way this motion takes place has to do with a break between S3A and S3B to displace the S4 through part of the membrane. Now, if you think about this in a mechanical kind of way, you've got this core and you've got these voltage sensors out here. And if membrane voltage is driving a conformation, they're somehow working on the pore. But one thing that's puzzled us about these structures, this and some earlier structures of voltage-dependent channels, is how mechanically can this electrical work that's done on the voltage sensor get transmitted to the pore when it's very kind of not very well attached to the pore? Why don't you just twist this domain? Why doesn't it just torque the domain? Why does it seem to efficiently work on the pore? And I think the answer has to do, at least in part, with if you break a voltage sensor off the pore and look at it. So here's a voltage sensor snapped off the pore. And now you look at where it contacts. It contacts in three places. Two of them are shown as red and one as blue. So this is touching here, the blue is touching here, and the red is touching here. Now, the reason I made them different colors is because if you do a sequence analysis of different voltage-dependent potassium channels, you discover that residues here, the kind of residue you find here, depends on the kind of residue here. It's a cross-correlation analysis. And again, the residues here depend on what residues are here. The blue ones, it's not the case. I would say they just happen to be touching in the crystal structure, but you don't see a suggestion of co-evolved positions. Now, what's interesting about this is we know that this is a very important region. So I'll show these red regions in the next picture. This is very important. It's been shown by a number of labs that mutations, so recognize this helix that makes the cuff around the pore. It is making very specific contacts with the pore, and in fact, mutations in here disrupt coupling of the voltage sensor to the pore. And up here is the other red position, and it's very small and localized, but it's with the top. At the top, the voltage sensor is kind of leaning in the pore, and it's kind of stuck there. We see this in the crystal structures. And in fact, if you mutate this region, you can disrupt the ability of the voltage sensor to work on the channel. So I think the voltage sensor is stuck here on the top and kind of being held in place so that when the transmembrane voltage is working on the charges that are distributed on the S4, that this part shown in red is what we call the mobile part of the voltage sensor, is able to move, but the part shown in blue is more static and kind of held in place. So in a sense, if I have to, work on something, if I lean here, I can do it better than if I, push myself over trying to undergo a conformational change here without having a contact point. So I think the way the forces are distributed has to do with the very specific contacts, though small, that the voltage sensor makes with the pore. For purposes of time, I just want to jump to the last point right here. And it's a point I raised at the beginning. And that is, so this is titled, What is the Significance of the Every Third Periodicity? And I remember back in my lab at Harvard, long before coming to Rockefeller, Kenton was there. We used to have long, Kenton Jalu and Rama Ranganathan would have long discussions about how things could work. And it's fun to think back on those days because, you know, we didn't have structural information, but we thought a lot about things, and we had mutagenesis studies and read other people's studies. And one thing we used to wonder, and I think we all agreed, that, you know, there's something very funny about this every third position of the arginines. And this was first demonstrated by Shosaku Numa in the cloning of the voltage-dependent sodium channel. And then we saw it in voltage-dependent calcium channels, and then from the work of Jan and Pong's Tanaway on voltage-dependent potassium channels, that this S4 region has arginines at every third position. And that, in fact, led to the idea of what's called a helical screw. And the reason that is because a helix has 3.5 amino acids per turn. So what that, an alpha helix, one of these ribbons. So that means if you have an arginine at every third position, that will kind of rotate itself around the helix because it's not matched. And so the idea was, well, how, you know, the idea was that these arginines must somehow move through the membrane. And in order to do this, maybe the helix rotates. The problem is you don't have universal joints at the end of a protein helix. So that's hard to do. So there's one feature of the structure that is very, very interesting and I think gives the answer to this question about why every third. And so it turns out that the S4, this helix closest to us with the charges on it, from here down is what's called a 310 helix. It's not every 3.5, it's every 3 per turn precisely. So it may, if you look down at it, it makes a triangle. And that means in this part of the helix down here, the arginines are all in one stripe, looking into the voltage sensor. At the top here, it's an alpha helix, and you can see there are arginine, so polar residue positions, that wrap around the helix to the outside, in fact, look in the lipid membrane at the top. But down in here, at the center of the membrane and below, they're on a stripe looking in. So this is a hypothesis, but what I think happens is when the voltage sensor paddle moves, driving essentially the S4 pulls down, I think what happens is one at a time, the alpha helix ratchets into a 310. It would just involve a single hydrogen bond switch between amino acids adjacent, not adjacent in the polypeptide chain, but adjacent on the turn of the helix. So it's one swap. And the effect that will have is as this comes down, it will turn a side chain that's looking out in. And so more based on the extreme conservation of every third position that we see in voltage sensors than on the structure, I'd say that the 310 helix explains this. These every third position are not in a 310 helix. They're on an alpha, but I think it turns into a 310 when it comes down. Of course, this is a hypothesis, and all hypotheses could be wrong, and usually are, but I bet you this one won't be wrong. We will see. But I think, at least in my mind, it explains why we see the every third periodicity in voltage-dependent channels. We have a long way to go, but I think we're starting to get a real picture of this kind of this little machine in that you have the channel. It's a simple little mechanical device. It's a pore that's open. It's got helices wrapped around it that can be pushed down like levers that are directly attached to the S4 helix that have arginines. And these little voltage sensors are poised in the membrane to sense the membrane voltage, undergo a conformational change and due to the electric field across the membrane, and push down on the pore. So finally, people who have worked for a long time on this project in the lab, Steve Long, solved the structure of KV1.2 with Ernie Campbell, and with Xiao Tao, the structure of the paddle chimera. Alice Lee, Vanessa Ruta, Sukyung Lee, and Arnaban Banerjee have done extensive work on the KVAP voltage-dependent channel structure and function. And Sanjay was charged for channel a long time ago, and Motohiko Nishida determined the inward rectifier structure that I showed early in the talk. Thank you very much. Right.
In the early steps. And one of the questions that's really fascinating to me is in the sodium channel,
yeah,
where the full voltage sensors have different amino acid sequences but are related,
yeah,
there appears to be cooperativity,
right,
even though it's early steps. Do you have any thoughts about how that happens?
Yeah. So the question, you know, I made, in case, I'll just repeat it, that I made a comment that, you know, the evidence is that most of the voltage sensor motions in potassium channels happen independently, and then subsequent to their motions, the pore undergoes its conformational change in a more concerted way. And really, I'm basing that on the electrophysiological, you know, what people concluded from, you know, Sigworth and Aldrich labs working on very detailed kinetic properties of the opening of this kind of channel. And I am just pointing out that the structure is compatible with that. But Kenson's asking, we know in sodium channels, which are going to be related, that the evidence is that they're not independently happening. And I don't have an answer for that other than it is certainly, I just say this, that when you look at the potassium channel, the way the inner helices cross each other, the problem is to open that aperture of the camera. You, in a sense, can't open one at a time, you see, because they kind of interdigitate with each other. So it's as if you have to pop them all open at once and close them all at once. So in a sense, if you had one voltage sensor down, the whole thing can't open until everybody is able to open, until there's room for everybody to open. Maybe in sodium channels there will be some real differences in the way this cuff helix engages the inner helices. I would imagine you'll have to make some interesting differences there. Because if you make those differences, then you could imagine being able to actually pull one open without pulling the others, but actually having an effect on whether the others will next open. It's almost as if the potassium channel is highly concerted in this sense, right? And maybe it's rigged so that the voltage sensors can move most of the way. I believe you have evidence that part of the movement of the voltage sensor is, in fact, coupled to pore opening, and there is, in a sense, talk through the pore around the voltage sensors, and it makes sense that that can happen. Depending on the details of the connection, I think you could make that extreme, in fact. In the most extreme cases, you could have a voltage sensor be able to move all by itself and actually lift an inner helix and open that part of the aperture of the camera without opening the other ones. And one subunit could be all done, but affect the probability that then the others could go, and it would give rise to the phenomenon that you're asking about. So it will be interesting to see the structure, the sodium channel.
Mark?
Rug, your functional mapping experiments with Vanessa was, yeah, withdrawn with the plane assuming that the uniform at the bilayer.
Right.
But what are your thoughts about actual movements of the bilayer?
Sure. Yeah. So the question is about the planes drawn with the assumption. Well, actually, so the planes were actually not drawn with any assumption. Those were just planes, and I didn't say it very well. Those were just planes placed in between inaccessible and accessible. So they were just put there based on the data. And then you sit back and say, well, how far apart are they? And they come out to be 29 angstroms apart, which corresponds to the thickness of the lipid bilayer. So I would say for this assay, that perturbations of the lipid membrane that undoubtedly do occur around membrane proteins and probably quite extremely around this weird kind of membrane protein with lots of charge in it, I think this assay doesn't pick those up because the avidin is so big. So the avidin is as large, one avidin tetramer is as large as the pore itself. So I think that the thing you're thinking about probably is extremely important, actually, to the function of the channel and how it all works. But I think this particular assay is completely insensitive to it because the evidence is so big. You see what I mean? So all it's reporting is like a dipstick experiment on depth. So we're actually missing that kind of information about the bilayer in its relationship to the channel.
So what are the prospects for getting a closed structure, I mean, given that it's not practical to put crystallization plates under a tenth of a foot
right.
hole per centimeter
yeah.
field with toxins and
trichomes? Yes. So. Yeah. So this is a great... The question is, it's what are the... So how are you going to... Basically, it's how you're going to get a closed confirmation and because I've talked to you about something that I said is very close to an open confirmation. And really the picture here that I have in mind and that I think most people have in mind is that this protein is sort of floating in the liquid crystal membrane. And this protein, we see it in its open conformation, I think, because, well, by definition, when you do an electrophysiology experiment, you see that this channel is open at 0 millivolts. You have to get very negative on the inside to close it. So you have to make, you know, in this channel, minus 80 or minus 90 millivolts to close it. And in our crystal, it's 0 millivolts, so it's sitting open. How are we going to get it closed? And it's a very good question. And, so if you could imagine trying to grow this, put the crystal in a field, and you make some calculations, and you discover you're never going to do it unless the resistance of that crystal is so low because you'll burn it up in microseconds from Joule heating. So how do you do it? The only way I can think of it that I hope works, but so far hasn't, is crystallize with lipid membrane, lipids, because they're kind of forming a quasi-membrane around it with particular lipids that can create a local environment that might be electrostatically more like closed. Easier said than done. So far it's failed, but it's the... I think it would be a beautiful experiment. It would be a beautiful outcome if it worked. Cross-linking would be not very satisfying, unfortunately, because disulfide bonds have lots of energy, and we could be cross-linking in a natural state. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.